I hope you enjoyed this week's all-new episode of Star Trek Discovery, available on CBS All Access. So, I've rounded up some of our fantastic guests to give us their reactions to this week's incredible episode, and here is what they had to say.
Hi, this is Lisa Klink with my brief review of Through the Valley of Shadows. I thought the Klingon Monastery looked really cool. The sets were awesome. The paintings were really cool. I wasn't as impressed by the resolution of the whole time crystal plot that brought us there. I mean, they set it up so that these monks would give their lives to protect these time crystals, and none of them may ever leave this place, ever, ever, ever. And then Pike shows up, and I kind of thought he'd have to go through a lot more to change their minds, that he would have to prove himself to these Klingons. Now, the choice that he had to make was a difficult one, to accept that future for himself. But when you think about it, the alternative is getting destroyed with the rest of sentient life in the galaxy. So really, it was kind of the lesser of two evils, if you want to look at it that way. I just thought that he should have had to go through a lot more to prove himself worthy of one of these crystals that was never going to leave this place. I was also a little surprised by the speech that he gave at the end about how we all have a role to play in destiny. When did he become so caught up in destiny as opposed to free will? It just didn't seem consistent with the character to me. I am still liking the Spock-Burnham relationship. Once that I have accepted Spock as a part of this show, I think the actor is actually really good. And I like the way that they're playing the relationship, even with, you know, just brief exchanges like, "I don't need your help, brother. Shall we go, sister?" I thought that was funny. And I like the way that Spock just shows up for her. Not in an emotional, you know, tell me about your feelings kind of way, but he's there. And that seems significant, to be there, literally physically be there for each other. I'm not crazy about Michael becoming the center of basically the control's entire plot, that as Spock says, that she's the one variable that it can't account for. And so somehow like neutralizing her or turning her into one of them is like the only way they can succeed. I don't think it's really necessary to make Michael the focal point of this. I mean, she has already decided to take on stopping control as a personal mission. And I don't think you need to make her, you know, the chosen one in any way to motivate her to do this. And I'm still not crazy about having a computer program as our big enemy of the season. I mean, it does personify itself, and the creeping along the floor, like particles or whatever it was kind of creepy. I mean, that whole sequence where Spock is trying to stop it was effective. But I still don't know how much I like having control at, you know, this disembodied program as our main adversary. I just think that there need to be people, like actual people, not taken over by control, but actual people who are cooperating with it, like voluntarily, because they think somehow that the universe needs to be destroyed or sentient life or something like that. Anyway, I would still rather have a person or alien rather than a program as our enemy. So those are my initial thoughts about Through the Valley of Shadows, and I am looking forward to next week.
Hi there, Alexandra August here with my thoughts on Star Trek Discovery 212 Through the Valley of Shadows. Overall, I thought this was a pretty momentous episode or a pretty ambitious episode that was very well executed. At first, I was a little frustrated that when Spock and Burnham go on their mission to the Section 31 ship, of course, the one living body they find is someone she happened to have worked with on the Shenzo, Lieutenant Cameron Gaunt. But the execution of that story and the acting was pretty impressive. So when we do find out that he's Section 31, it's not a total surprise. Pardon me. When we do find out that he's Control, it's not a total surprise, but it is very creepy. So the sort of horror factor of this story I found pretty interesting. And that's not the only part of this episode where we got that kind of element, which is not something we see particularly often in Star Trek. When Pike goes down to Boreth and grasps the time crystal and sees a look into his future, It feels like a horror story out of Alien. He sees himself fall victim to severe radiation burns, and then his disfigured visage, the one that we've seen in the menagerie, that we'll later see in the menagerie, or saw in the menagerie 40 years ago, depending on how you want to parse that, comes at him. It's very, very scary. Anson Mount did a phenomenal job conveying both the horror and the fear and the sadness now that he knows his future, but also his resolute Starfleet acceptance of it, which is that moment where he leans back against the crystal and says to himself, "You are Starfleet," is the pinnacle, I think, of Star Trek ideals and Starfleet values, which is that you're willing to sacrifice yourself pretty readily for the greater good of the universe, for humanity, for the greater good of what's happening, which I think is something that Anson Mount has nailed from day one, and part of what makes his Captain Pike so, so resonant with so many people. Also in Borek, we got to meet Tenevik, who is the... this is a soap opera. He would be the soap opera re-aging syndromed son of Laurel and Ash Tyler. Because of the timey-wimey stuff that goes on Boreth due to the time crystals, Tenevik were, I guess, just experience his time in a non-linear fashion, which ages him quickly. I did not totally understand all of that, but Kenneth Mitchell was phenomenal playing his not one, not first, not second, but third Klingon on Star Trek Discovery, and did a wonderful job. I enjoyed the conversations between him and Pike. I was just as interested in him as I was in Pike's journey, so I thought that was interesting. If I still find the concept of time crystals more magic technology than the more science and physics-based technology Star Trek has given us before. Not in love with Discovery's affinity for, again, like I said, magic technology, which is just completely out of the realm of any comprehension and isn't based on much in reality. But I'm willing to overlook it for this week because this week was so, so fun. And then finally, Colburn Stamets. I really like the way this is going now because I feel like this is an honest look at a couple who has been driven apart by forces beyond their control, despite what both of them may want. And I'm very, very curious to see what's going to happen between them. I don't know what's going to happen between them. That automatically invests me more. I have a sneaking suspicion that Discovery is going to go off on a very singular mission at the end of this season, and they will not be in the 22nd century, or sorry, they won't be in the 23rd century or the Alpha Quadrant when this season is over, and I think they'll be gone for a length of time. I'm curious to see whether or not Hugh Culber will be aboard the Discovery or whether or not he'll stay behind and appear on another spinoff or just appear on another spinoff or just make it a little bit, make Stamets and Culber just a little bit more star-crossed. I would love it for them to eventually come back together, but I'm really into the idea of them spending a fairly long time apart. Those are my thoughts. Thank you so much for tuning into Disco Nights, and we'll be back next week with our discussion of the finale.
Welcome back. This is Chase Masterson with Disco Nights and more, more, more. In the Valley of Shadows, Star Trek Discovery takes on Doctor Who-like issues as we grapple with the nature of time. Pike volunteers to do an away mission to the Klingon planet of Boreth. With us, he meets Laurel and Tyler's son, Tenevik, all grown up because of the nature of time, and played by the always powerful Ken Mitchell. Pike needs some time crystals that Tenevik is guarding, and Tenevik tells Pike he is not strong enough. Pike has a flash forward of the horrors that await him in time if he continues his quest to get the time crystal. Indeed, Pike is faced with the decision of how and whether to avoid that fate, but he says to himself in an iconic moment, "You're a Starfleet captain. You believe in service, sacrifice, compassion, and love." After facing the fact that his brutal future is one he doesn't foresee for himself, Pike takes the time crystal, sealing his fate. And the Discovery writers know how to keep us guessing even further with lines such as, "When the future becomes the past, the present will be unlocked." There are more spoilers as we find out that Lieutenant Gant is alive, or actually he was reanimated with horrific motives, wanting to turn Burnham on Discovery and use her to get the Sphere Archive, because she is the one variable Control cannot account for. Tig Notaro's back as Jet and Hugh swap stories about their marriages, and she too has a lesson to parlay about the nature of time, telling Hugh, "You have a second chance. It may not last forever. Don't screw it up." I loved seeing Mary Chifo back. Laurel wants to talk with Tyler about their relationship, and she lets go of Tyler, Voke. But later in the episode, they share a tender moment as they learn the state of their son and his name, Tenevic. We learn that Control is not just contained to Leland anymore. And at the end of the episode, we find out it is time to evacuate Discovery. And I know what you're thinking, enough about time and the nature of time. Let's hear about the real science of time and space. So here's J.D. Voyek.
Hello once again, listeners. It's J.D. Voyek coming to you recorded from my New Zealand studio, and it's time for this week's Moment of Disco Science. I've discussed time crystals in a previous segment, but we've learned this week that they don't just power time machines. They themselves are time machines. They age infants to fully grown adults and seeds to saplings to fully grown trees. Touching them also somehow seals your fate, but I'm going to ignore that and focus exclusively on the aging bit. We didn't see these crystals do anything with the past, which is actually quite interesting to anyone who knows anything about real-world time travel. Yes, I did just say real-world time travel. You've done it yourself. And it all comes down to Einstein's theories of special and general relativity. Time truly is relative, even beyond the sensation of being stuck in the world's most boring staff meeting for what seems like an eternity, or the old adage that time flies when you're having fun. Relativity teaches us that we exist not just in three-dimensional space, but in a 4D space-time. And our speed through space-time is constant, equal to the speed of light. That total speed is broken into our velocity through space, which includes our walking around the surface of the planet, Earth's rotation and revolution around the sun, the solar system's travels around the Milky Way, and so on. The other part of that is how quickly our internal clock ticks, our perception of how time passes. The faster we travel through space, the less quickly we're allowed to travel through time. The slower you go, the more quickly you age. So if you go for a jog while your partner stays home and binges that show you hate, assuming you're moving in the correct direction relative to the Earth spinning, you will come back to the house having aged less than they did. It's imperceivably less, because relative to the speed of light, you're still effectively standing still, but you are technically a time traveler. To get a noticeable effect, you have to travel at a solid fraction of the speed of light. Like, if you hopped on a spaceship and spent a year traveling at 90% the speed of light, 167-ish thousand miles a second, you would return to an Earth and humanity 2 years older than when you left. To skip forward a century, you'd have to spend a year zooming at 99.995% the speed of light, or a day at 99.9999996% the speed of light. The difference between these fractions is really tiny in the grand scheme of things, but as you continue to speed up, the energy required to speed up climbs higher and higher. So you'd basically need an infinite amount of energy to accelerate your ship or your body to the speed of light, which is why nothing with mass can travel the universe's speed limit, and warp drives are a thing to get around that. But long story short, by traveling super fast through space, your perception of the passage of time slows down relative to everyone else, so more time passes for them than it does for you. Time also slows in the presence of a stronger gravitational field. For anyone who remembers that old show Andromeda, that's how Kevin Sorbo and his eponymous ship end up in the future, by hanging out too close to a black hole. I mean, it's either that example or Nolan's Interstellar. So seeing Laurel and Voke's child grow up far more quickly than he should have is kind of the opposite of what we would expect. For a real-life example, astronauts orbiting on the International Space Station not only age more slowly because they're traveling at 17,500 miles an hour while we humans are spinning at less than 1,000, they age more quickly because they're further away from Earth's center of gravity. Those don't quite cancel each other out, though. It ends up for about a 6-month stay on the space station, an astro or cosmonaut will have effectively time traveled into the future a whole 5 milliseconds. So yeah, don't start hoping for time travel tourism companies to pop up anytime soon, especially since this only works for travel to the future. You can't use relativity to travel into the past or de-age yourself relative to anyone else. For anyone wondering if this isn't all just math, It's not. We've done experiments using super accurate atomic clocks that get synchronized before the experiment and end up with different times after it. And GPS satellites orbiting far above Earth, beyond even the ISS, have to employ the rules of relativity to compensate for how they perceive time compared to how all of us back on Earth do. In other words, modern living is time travel, which might not be as cool to you as getting to go back and be eaten by a non-avian theropod or trying to prevent the elimination of all sentient life in the galaxy, but is kind of magical in its own way. This has been your moment of Disco Science. Until next time.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Alexandra and Lisa. Really always a pleasure to have you and your voices here on the show. And thanks to you guys. Thank you, our audience, for joining us for Disco Nights. And if you're a fan of this podcast, you may want to check out Electric Surge's other podcasts, including 4:30 Movie every Friday and Inglourious Trekspurts, the podcast about all things Trek with co-hosts Mark Altman and Darren Doctorman. It's available every Saturday evening at 17:01 hours. That's not 17:02, by the way, 17:01, wherever you listen to podcasts. A very special thanks to Bill Ritter, our engineer, and everybody here at Electric Surge. And we really appreciate you making the show possible. Join us next Sunday and every Sunday for an all-new disco party to make sure you bring your disco shoes. This is Chase Masterson saying disco lives, and I'll see you next week.
This podcast is a production of the Electric Surge Network.